Time for a little bit more cannabis science, and joined on Wednesday, as we always are, by Dr. Mitch Earlywine, Associate Professor of Psychology at the State University of New York in Albany, and probably one of the nation's foremost researchers on cannabis. So, Dr. Mitch, welcome to the show.
Great to be back.
Hey, I saw that your job was in danger. was it a police officer, somebody that got a little upset about you speaking out on cannabis?
This is interesting because I, of course, over the years, I always get emails sent to me saying, oh, you're wrong and you're Satan and you're killing our children and stuff like that. And I'm always happy to engage with folks who aren't on the same side as me on the cannabis debate. But this was somebody who actually emailed the president of the university.
No.
Of course, I didn't appreciate it all. And I just wanted to say, you know, if you've got a bone to pick with me, by all means, pick it with me. But also that the university has been incredibly supportive. I am really grateful to SUNY Albany and our provost for both responding to this person who sent an email to the president and really supporting me and being able to, you know, enjoy academic freedom, go out there and speak the truth and not have to be subject to some kind of concerns about my own job security. So big thumbs up for SUNY.
Yeah, good for them. And, you know, this always bothers me when it comes to this debate on the war on drugs, more so than it seems like almost any other subject, that people aren't even willing to debate it. As soon as you bring up a contrary point of view, they just want to shut you down. And maybe that's because their argument is on such shoddy footing.
I find that they're often the ones who quickly run to these moral, oh, it's intuitively obvious that this is just evil kind of arguments, and so then any presentation of data doesn't reach them. But as I've pointed out before, Doug Cusack talks about the morals behind drug prohibition and just says, you know, we live in a country where we like to see the punishment fit the severity of the crime, meaning if a crime causes other people a lot of harm, by all means the punishment should be severe, but what, in truth, is the harm anyone is causing somebody else by owning a plant? Obviously nothing. So what should our penalty be?
Exactly. Now, getting to the cannabis science here, there's a new report out from CASA, which is the National Center on Addiction and Substance Abuse, Joe Califano's group. And I love the title of this one, Non-Medical Marijuana 3, Rite of Passage or Russian Roulette? Ooh, boy, that's scary. But there's all sorts of interesting stats in here. He points out from 92 to 2006, there was a 175% jump in potency from 3.2 to 8.8% THC, a 492% increase in the teen treatment admissions for marijuana, 188% increase in teen treatment for drug of abuse. I mean, this is, once again, we've got this whole potency argument coming out and the teen treatment argument coming out. Let's shoot this down with some real science.
Sure thing. I mean, I went to Columbia. CASA is there. I feel like they do some neat things. They had a day where they said, okay, everybody should have dinner with the family. Of course, a big fan of those kinds of things. But these reports really hurt their credibility and, in fact, can hurt some of our credibility with teens. As you know, I've got a book out, The Parent's Guide to Marijuana, and I'm really into making sure that folks don't use marijuana too early in life in order to avoid negative consequences. However, jumping up and down about increases in potency is not the way to make this happen. I'm afraid that, in fact, these, oh, it's all new potent and really scary messages are actually encouraging folks through that forbidden fruit kind of effects we've talked about before. Now, anytime you see anybody taking a percentage of a percentage, I feel like we got to start getting suspicious. So, yes, cannabis used to be 3.2% THC on average, and now it's 8.8 on average. But this is all based on seized samples. It's really all about who happened to get busted and whose pot ended up going down to Mississippi to get evaluated. And in truth, if they had wanted to examine, you know, more of different set of samples, we have no idea really what on average is the percent THC. But the tacit assumption, again, is that this is somehow more dangerous. And in fact, we do have laboratory data showing that people inhale less when they're using stronger cannabis, and that there's an opportunity for fewer respiratory problems as a result of smaller inhalations. And, you know, as we've talked about time and again, if folks are vaporizing, this shouldn't be an issue anyway. But the other thing that just kind of makes me laugh is the consistent message Joe Califano is saying, today's pernicious pot is not your parents' pot. Well, if you're, you know, 17 years old and you hear, hey, today's pot is not your parents' pot, what do you think? Good. I don't want my parents high. You know? And in fact, that's kind of a steal from some of the old car ads. They're like, hey, this is not your dad's car. Like, your dad's car was some old fogey's car, and this is a really cool car. And now we're essentially saying, hey, your dad's pot was some old fogey pot, and we've got the good pot now. And so I'm really apprehensive about this approach. Now, these treatment admissions, I've also talked about before, this is really suspicious to me. Okay, yes, more teens are going into treatment for cannabis-related problems, or so they say, but in fact, a lot of this is because they get in trouble for a possession bust and get the opportunity to either, you know, do some time or go to a treatment program, and what a surprise, they pick going to the treatment program. Incidentally, the diagnosis of cannabis abuse has one symptom that is trouble with the law. So here you pass a law that makes this possession illegal, then you bust people for it, you make that bust a category for getting this diagnosis, and then you say, gee, this diagnosis is up.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just such a wild house of cards that I feel like interpreting these stats has become this kind of smoke and mirrors exercise instead of where we ought to focus, which is, look, we've seen teens show decreases in IQ if they start heavy use of marijuana early in life. We've seen teens show altered brain structure if they start marijuana use early in life. These are true data-supported assertions. Let's focus on these. And then let's ask teens themselves, what are the things that are important to them? This idea that this is either a rite of passage, meaning every teen has to do it, or Russian roulette, you're holding a gun to your head with a bullet in it, is just too dichotomous and really not getting the point across in a way that I think is going to make for efficient substance abuse prevention.
And I think we've shown here in a tax and regulated market where we use education to get to kids that we can have an effect on their use, and that market would be tobacco. You know,
an ideal comparison. And in fact, when you look at perceptions of risk on tobacco and use, we're seeing tobacco use down. I mean, why does everybody have to stand outside their building in the cold in order to smoke a cigarette now? It's because people have said, oh, this is really dangerous. We want to change this. And I think that that's an intriguing way to go about this with marijuana as well. And unfortunately, when you look at the data, in fact, you realize marijuana probably isn't as dangerous as tobacco as far as a lot of health consequences are concerned. And so then that kind of undermines our whole prohibition anyway.
Yeah, and the idea of, you know, sentencing people to treatment, I can't imagine that there's a lot of drug treatment counselors out there who are, you know, dealing with some really serious hard cases of abuse that they really want their space utilized by people who don't belong there. I can't imagine that's something that the professional community is in favor of. Are they?
Folks who don't belong there or folks who are there as part of their sentence are really, really tough on burnout. And substance abuse treatment providers burn out really easily. If you last 5 years in this field, it's really to your credit. And I bow down to these guys who are spending 40 hours a week sitting across from folks who are, you know, at risk for relapse all the time. I mean, it's really, really difficult, draining work. But then you get somebody in there who's clearly in there only because the judge basically said, you've got to go, and, you know, they're hanging their head, they're bored out of their minds, and you're really burning clinical time that you could be devoting to somebody else. It's really a tough situation. Every once in a while, you say the thing or something happens, and you do get the chance to turn them around, and I want to definitely praise these programs that turn folks to treatment rather than prison. But again, we shouldn't essentially throw teens into prison or treatment based on a single possession charge. It just doesn't seem to fit the best use of our resources as far as treatment is concerned.
Yeah, and it goes back to that idea of use versus abuse, and they see that all use is some sort of abuse that needs treatment. And I always counter that by saying, you know, what if we had sentenced to treatment everybody who ever got a hangover? We'd see, you know, a huge increase in alcohol treatment, but that wouldn't mean we have a whole bunch more alcoholics necessarily.
Very much so. That's absolutely the case.
Now, in these stats that the CASA report comes across here, you know, they doing the potency thing here again, and, you know, we've debunked this a number of times, but I think one of the things I like to point out in this is the incredibly wide range of variants that they find in the potency. You know, they have some of these samples that go down into the industrial hemp range of, you know, sub 1% THC, all the way up to these, you know, high varieties that are up into the 20s and 30s in THC, you know, this huge range of variants. And I think that would also speak to, you know, what are the kids really getting a hold of? Are they really getting a hold of this connoisseur marijuana? Is that more likely to be medical marijuana that they wouldn't have access to? Is there any way of telling exactly what the kids are getting a hold of?
It's funny because before he died, John Morgan actually had proposed an idea that we could get folks to send in samples and actually try to compare subjective effects across different dosages. But the bottom line is we just don't know. Odds are high the high THC cannabis is way more expensive than anything most teens could afford. But again, the subjective effects don't seem to increase linearly. So a 9% THC cannabis doesn't get you three times higher than a 3% THC cannabis. And some recent work from Don Abrams' lab shows even with the vaporizer, as you crank up the THC level, that doesn't necessarily mean people are going to get higher and higher or something along those lines. So I feel like in some ways the THC percentage can be a little bit of a red herring. In my lab, some of my students and I have been sitting down and comparing arrest records and THC amounts, and it actually looks like the arrests are driving the THC. So the more arrests, then the following year, the THC seems to go up yet again.
Hmm.
And I'm concerned about this, as you've talked about before, how in alcohol prohibition, we moved from folks having a beer once in a while to suddenly everybody's got an illicit market and they need to get as much alcohol in as small a space as possible, and suddenly everybody's drinking whiskey. I feel like, again, these increases in arrests may be driving this stronger THC, not that the stronger THC is some kind of scary thing to be frightened of, but it's really in some ways an index of how prohibition has altered the way folks are forced to grow and distribute the cannabis.
Well, we could probably go off on this potency and these false statistics here for quite a bit longer, but we've kind of run out of time here. Before we go, Dr. Earlywine, you know, these fears are stoked from a very legitimate fear, and that is, you know, parents that are worried about their kids getting involved with marijuana. Give us some words of advice. How could parents, you know, just real basically lead their kids away from marijuana without having to resort to these stupid scare tactics?
I feel like I detail this in the parent's guide, but the bottom line is sitting down and having a candid conversation about what are the pros and cons of early use. And in fact, we do see that using early in life isn't adaptive in the long run. You increase your probability of dependence. There's evidence of changes in IQ and changes in brain structure. And then letting your kids do most of the talking. So you let them talk about what's going on, and you say uh-huh and yes, and let them really get this as part of just, you know, your general relationship, and it'll be intriguing to see what you learn from them. And then instead of doing it, you know, in one single tirade, talking about it a little bit and then bringing it up again later. So it may not be a one-time sit-down hour-long conversation so much as an ongoing back and forth about drugs, intoxicants, health, general health, education, and everything. And that this is really just one aspect of your own multifaceted relationship with your kids.
Well, I highly recommend that people get a copy of Parents' Guide to Marijuana. We'll have a link to that up on our blog at stash.normal.org. And, wow, what do you know? If you talk to your kids, good things might happen. Well, Dr. Lewine, thanks for joining us here on the Daily Audio Stash.
Oh, thanks so much.
All right.